I don't think every coach needs to be some high level weightlifter, but they think they do need to have experienced in any sport, that sport, to understand what they might be thinking at that time so that you can preempt it with maybe giving the proper feedback or cue that you know they're probably feeling physically or might be telling themselves mentally so that they can take on board what you're saying and it actually marries better with what they're feeling. So then it'll make a little bit more sense.
Welcome to Evidence Strong Show, Erin. It's my pleasure to have you the second time. We talked before about the paper, National Strength and Conditioning Association position statement on weightlifting for sports performance, and covered topics of forward and reverse training. So teaching weightlifting from bottom to top or the other way around. What are pros and cons of two methods and which one is recommended? We talked about the stages of learning, so how the athlete will learn the skill, how to spot at which stage the athlete is and how to move them to the next stage. And we talked through regressions, transitions, and auxiliary exercises and how to use them effectively to teach weightlifting. So that's what we talked about in the previous one. Today we'll be talking about errors and feedback. But before we do that, for one or two people who haven't seen the previous one and meet you for the first time, could you briefly introduce yourself?
Sure. Thanks again for having me. This has been fun. My name's Erin Hoff. I've been a strength and conditioning coach and weightlifting coach for about 32 years now, first in the United States, and now I live in Australia. I've worked with youth through to professional athlete, high school, Division I university in the United States as an assistant strength coach, and then professional netball strength coach here in Australia for a little while. And now I'm primarily teaching weightlifting to master's students at ECU, as well as for the Australian Weightlifting Federation. And for the International Weightlifting Federation, I work with the education program there. Been on several resistance training studies, peer-reviewed publications, chapters, etc. And like I said, primarily I'm just working with coaching and teaching education courses for Australian and the International Weightlifting Federation, as well as being on over 16 international appointments and about 11 of those as a head coach, working primarily with youth and junior athletes and assistant coaching with senior athletes. So that's kind of where I've been for the last few years since we moved to Australia.
This is definitely impressive. What a treat to have you. So let's start with maybe a definition of an error. So what is an error in Olympic weightlifting?
Well, an error is it's anything that's going to affect the ability to perform the skill appropriately. Errors can come in many different forms. There are several different classifications of errors. Whether or not you should address them or not address them, those are all things that we'll get into today. So let's look at first the classification of types of errors that you will see. So one of the types of errors you'll just see is in a body position. And what I mean by that is, for example, if you're in a liftoff position and the shoulders are behind the bar, that's a body position error. It says the shoulders should be slightly in front of the bar, not behind it in that liftoff position. Another type of body position error might be that the upper body doesn't get vertical in the jerk dip position. So if you have someone that's slightly like leaning forward or hunched or something like that, it is a body position error. Another type of error is movement characteristic. So this is when the athlete might be in the right positions, but the movement pattern is slightly incorrect, meaning they might in the jerk, they might be dipping too fast when it's supposed to be a controlled dip to a very fast drive. They might be going down and fast, you know, down really quickly. So dipping too fast, cutting the pole or the top of the pole of the extension and getting a full extension. Another type of error would be balance and stability. So you're looking at their lack of balance or stability in, let's say, a receiving position. So they're not locked out thoroughly, like braced and holding position. They're moving or they're rocking or their arms are, you know, not in the correct lockout position. Weight distribution in their feet, that's usually a very typical one that you'll see where you're getting a lot of, whether it's, and this can happen at any point of the lift, where the weight is shifting too far forward in a particular part of the lift, or the fact that you've got weight in their feet rocking from forward to back and forward to back instead of being rather stable. There is movement, if we get into the biomechanics of all that, there is movement happening in the foot, but and for an athlete, when you're watching an athlete, there shouldn't be extreme movement where, and then they stay in that forward position. It should have, it goes with the bar, but again, that's all biomechanical stuff. And that's a little bit out of the realm of where we're going here, but we're happy to discuss that at another time. Lack of confidence is another type of error you're going to see. Usually that comes in the form of an athlete. You see them pausing or hesitating when they're into a certain point of the lift, especially when we're coming through, let's say, to the transition or second pole. You'll actually see them pause in that position, diving under the ball. Let's stay with the slower movement. They're either hesitating, pausing, or their lack of commitment to it. So they're hesitating to go under the bar, wherever it is, whether it's a snatch or a clean reception or a jerk. But conversely, you'll have people that in their lack of confidence, their fear they're not going to be going fast enough or get there in time, they dive under the bar instead of waiting for the extension, or they move too quickly off the floor in the start. So their knees aren't able to get out of the way fast enough. And so then they end up with other issues related to that. So that lack of confidence can put bars into or body parts into different positions that they can't then accurately perform the lift. So we need to be looking at those. Other ones might be flexibility or movement limitation. That could be joint restriction. If they have like their hips lock up or they have a problem with the shoulders, anything that will affect their ability to get correctly into a position effectively and hold the position effectively. So those can also be limiters. And bracing. An athlete who, for example, may round or hyperextend their back position when they're lifting the bar. Rear foot instability in the jerk. You've got, instead of having the toe facing or the foot facing towards so the knee is over the toe, they might have the knee in this position, but their toe is flaring out in the back. And the lack of being able to stabilize then in that position. And I'm actually seeing more and more inability to hold positions in the front foot as well in the jerk. So that leads to, when you got too much movement, that leads to instability in the rest of the, as it travels up the body. So those are basically six types or categories of errors that you might see. When you have an error, you've got to think about what are going to be your high level or high priority errors and what are going to be not so or low priority errors. And the biggest thing is a high priority error, first and foremost, is it going to cause an injury? If they continue to do it, is it going to hurt them? Whether it's going to hurt them at that moment or it's going to ultimately cause one over time, you need to address that. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Another high priority factor might be you're thinking to yourself as a coach, if it's not fixed now, will that become an ingrained pattern that's going to make it harder for me to fix later? For example, if they pull with their arms, you might be kind of just letting that go, thinking, oh, it'll work itself out. But if they just keep doing it and it's never corrected, it's not working itself out. It's being accepted. My husband and I always say, what you ignore, you condone. We do need to be looking for something like, okay, what they're pulling with their arms. Or again, like I said before, if they're raising their hips too fast off the floor, that is another issue, because then it puts in the bar, moves the bar, shifts the weight forward. So then the bar is moving forward and then you're basically looping it around. And as it starts at the bottom, anything that happens below the waist is going to be exacerbated above the waist. So if you're already starting and the bar is moving this way, it's just going to keep doing this all the way up the body. And that's usually where you end up, either too far out front and say in the snatch, the bar is going to be too far out front, or you're going to jam it through and it's going to get too far behind you in the back. Either one, not ideal. So again, it's finding they are raising their hips too quickly off the floor, then that is something that needs to be, because it should be shoulders and hips moving together simultaneously, not teeter-tying the way up the body. So we've said basically, if it's going to injure the athlete, that's key. If it's going to become ingrained or harder to fix later, that's going to be another one that's considered high priority. You need to make sure you start nipping that in the bud right away. Will it immediately impact the overall movement? Okay. For example, If you have excessive horizontal displacement of the bar, forward or backwards, wherever it's coming around on the body, that would lead to an instability in the ability to hold the bar, for example, overhead in the snatch. If you've got too far forward, like I said before, then you can't hold it. I mean, that's the shoulders trying to hold it as the bar's too far out in front of you. Secondly, if it's too far behind you, so horizontally displaced too far behind you, that's going to put you in a hard position to stabilize it through the upper back, because it's too far behind you. You have to stabilize with the shoulder. That can lead to a shoulder injury, you know, so that it kind of just ticks all the boxes then. So that's another reason you need to be looking for that. And does it prevent the achievement of the primary objective of the exercise? So those are the four main things. So for example, on that one, if you're, say, doing a jerk and your transition between the dip and the drive, your torso is collapsing, that's going to impede the ability. The primary objective of the dip and the drive is to create a vertical movement. You've just impeded that because you're now moving, you collapse. Now things are going to be moving in a forward position. So that would also need to be addressed. Those are high priority. The thing is with errors and feedback, and I'm just going to segue into a little bit into that feedback. This is a tough one, especially with beginning people, because you have to figure out what to say, when to say it, what's appropriate, what's not appropriate, how is it going to be received, was it received, and how much. That's a big one, because you want to help them, but at the same time, we need to be teaching them. Remember that I'd said it before, that a coach is a teacher. We need to give them the tools, but we need to let them explore a little bit on their own, because they have to be able to, with a sport like weightlifting, they have to be able to understand and read what their body is telling them. And if we are telling them what it's saying, they stop listening to their body and they only listen to us. And that's why I would say the coach is a source. They're not the Bible. You need to be taking on board what they're saying with what you're feeling. And you need, and as a coach, and this is where I don't think every coach needs to be some high level weightlifter, but they think they do need to have experienced in any sport, that sport, to understand what they might be thinking at that time, so that you can preempt it with maybe giving the proper feedback or cue that you know they're probably feeling physically or might be telling themselves mentally, so that they can take on board what you're saying and it actually marries better with what they're feeling. So then it'll make a little bit more sense. A beginner needs constant feedback because, like I said in the previous discussion that we had, they don't know how to read that kinesthetic, that internal dialogue that's happening. They don't, and they might feel, because you have some of their athletes that are very kinesthetically aware, but that doesn't mean they know how to fix it and they know what to do. So a coach is providing that guidance, but at the same time, a guidance on how to interpret those messages and that proprioceptive feedback that they're getting. But at the same time, you need to avoid overcorrecting. So there's that fine line that we're talking about, because if you give too much feedback, they stop listening to themselves and they stop trying to listen to what they're hearing, and they're only trying to go with whatever you tell them. And then they get to a point where they can't function without you giving feedback. And that leads to another thing. If you give feedback often and then you stop giving feedback, even if it's just for one or two reps or two sets or whatever, they will assume something's wrong, because you're not saying anything. So you have to pick and choose when you're going to give it to them. And it can be nonverbal as well as verbal. It doesn't always have to be verbal cueing or verbal feedback. If you look at someone, you're like, that's feedback, you know, and they're looking at it like, oh, why are you giving me that look? That must have been horrible. You know, conversely, if somebody does something well, you're like, you know, I didn't have to say anything. They can see it on my face, right? So they're reading everything. And the younger they are, the more attuned they are, believe it or not, because they haven't had enough time with themselves athletically to understand what their body's saying, versus if you get a novice who is an adult, they've gone through life a lot longer with functioning with their body and listening to their body, and they have a better understanding of at least what that might be telling them, you know, and they have a little bit of an interpretation. Finding that line of how much is too much and what's not enough. And it always depends too on whom you're working with, but I would always suggest that you prioritize and address one, maybe two things at a time, and be very precise and clear about what you're addressing, but also in a using different communication methods, because you don't know, especially if you're working with someone for the first time or you're learning this person, you don't know how they learn unless you put them through a test, because there are tests for that where you can find out how they acquire and, you know, learn from, you know, whether it's auditory or visual or visual or kinesthetic. We have to address, a teacher does this in a classroom all the time. We can give the same instruction, but we do it in several different ways to reach all those different learning styles. And that's kind of how you need to do that here, because not everyone, and I don't know, I've been teaching since, like I said, 1991 is when I actually started teaching as well. I don't think I know one student who's just this or just that. We're always in some kind of combination or percentages of one and another. So usually you want to mix it up so that if they're not getting it one way and you try a different way, that might get in a little bit. Combination of those two might make more sense to that athlete versus just keep saying something over and over again. You know, the infamous, we used to see these in movies all the time. It was always a stereotypical joke, but it's true. When you see those movies, when somebody's speaking to someone who's a foreign to your language, or your nation. So it was obviously being raised in the US, we always had English. So if they met someone who wasn't English, then they just keep saying the same sentence, but louder, as if that's going to make more sense, right? So if we just keep repeating the same thing and it's not working, then it's not working. We need to try something else. And louder doesn't always mean better, but we do need to be a positive. You're going to get more with sugar than vinegar. Okay, so we need to be positive with it, but not sugarcoat it to the extent like you're saying, or if they're doing wonderful, if they look like stir-fried poo-poo. You need to be honest with them, but you have to be careful and modulate how you get that across. All right, so, but we're looking for that biggest limiting factor, that if we can correct that, and that's that high priority error, okay? If we can correct that, then those lower priority errors might actually just kind of dissolve, because you fixed it by getting rid of the bigger problem. So then the outcome's more positive, you're enhancing better learning, enthusiasm to keep going. So when do we give those correctments? It depends on the coach's bandwidth. Where do they draw the line on what's acceptable, not acceptable? Some guidelines could be, do I need to give feedback in these instances? And I'm going to say these ones, yes. And they're gonna be very similar to something we've already discussed. First one, you give feedback if it's going to risk injury, because we need to change what's happening or they're going to get hurt. And again, it might not be immediate, but it will be definitely somewhere down the line. So for example, if you have an athlete who turns their foot, their heel in or their toe out and their back foot when they're jerking, the first times they do that, they don't think anything of it. It's not a big deal, but studies have shown, and it's 9 times out of 10, the athlete will put their ACL in a very grave disadvantaged position and most likely will injure it in some way, shape, or form if that particular technique style continues, period. So we want to correct that. Yes, you give feedback if the results are a deliberate change on the athlete's part because they think that this particular change in technique or strategy is going to help them more, and it actually probably will not, then you need to. So if they're making a physical change, for example, the biggest one we deal with at the moment is a athlete's wanting to mimic the potentiating the off the floor. So they're basically kind of rock, you know, like pumping their hips and before they lift up off the floor. Maybe not everybody knows. I know. My husband has worked through the studies of, and we've talked to several coaches whose athletes use this particular style, and notably the Chinese, because that is one that posts it up all the time, to potentiate the lift off the floor and get some momentum going into that so that you can accelerate a little bit better off the floor. The problem with that is that most people, I don't think, may or may not realize, is that you have to have a certain amount of hip strength or squatting strength to be able to perform that effectively, to get the most out of that. So I have athletes that are doing that who are not strong enough to make that effective. And by strong enough for that particular movement, without getting too much into it, is you're looking at what, 2.5 to 3 times body weight squat. So I know for a fact that my athletes can't do that. So for them to add that, thinking that it's giving them that little bit of something, is actually not. And the problem with the novice is not only from the strength or the getting the most out of what that's supposed to be doing for you is not going to happen. The other issue you have there is an athlete who's not already consistent, because they're novice in this case, because we're talking about beginner. They don't know where that liftoff start position is. The Chinese, if you watch them when they do it, as soon as when they lift off, their hips are always in the same space or the same spot before the bar starts to break the floor, even though they've moved their hips. Athletes who do not know where that is because they're learning it are going to be very inconsistent on where that start position then is when the bar starts to lift off the floor. So then you're ending up with, if you do that 3 or 4 or 5 times, you're ending up with 3 or 4 or 5 different start positions, not effective. So something needs to be said, you know, and I usually correct them because I say, well, so-and-so does it, or I've seen this or whatever. And the easy way around that, to be honest, for me is to say yes. And that, and when you get to a lifting of that many years, or if you have that strength level, that is fine. I explained to them, this is what you need to be able to do for that to work. So when we get there, then we can address this and we can come back to it. Until that time, I need to see that you can hit that start position the same every single time. So let's start from a static position and we'll work from there. Another thing that you want to make sure you give feedback for is if you see an error more than 2 times in a row. If you see it once, don't be ready to just jump on in, because it could be just a one-off. It could be they weren't focusing. It could be just, it's a fluke. But if you see it multiple times, the same error multiple times, then yes, you want to make some kind of comment or correction or draw their attention to it. If you give them feedback and then you give them ample time to change their technique or the way they're performing the lift, and they're not showing any change, then you need to say something again, because they either don't, and this comes to the last one, they interpret feedback incorrectly. They're either not understanding you or what you're asking, or they don't know how to implement it correctly. So you either need to find a different way to say it or to get at it or demonstrate it, or you would ask them, when I say this, what do you think I mean? So you want to understand what they're interpreting to make sure that they're on the same page as you.
Could you also tell us how to check whether athletes receive and how much they receive? Are there any ways the coaches can use to make sure that what they said is received and to assess how much of it was received?
There's a lot of things that happen around that can affect or change how the athlete receives. First thing is if it's just utter chaos where they're training, because then their focus is in. The other thing is and this sounds really innocuous, but if the music, like, because we have music playing in the background of ours, you know, if the music is too loud and they can't hear me, then how are they going to get the information, you know? Or an athlete sometimes will listen to headphones. And I tell them, I said, if you're lifting, and I don't have a lift with headphones on, but like we're at a competition and they're trying to be within themselves, right? Then I tell them, I said, when you are going to lift, the headphones come out. I said, but if you're just sitting there and I want the music down enough so that if I were to come over and say, at least say your name, you can hear me. So then you can take the, you know, I want you to know, because I don't want to be yelling at you for you to hear me. So eliminating distraction can help. I'm not saying train without music, although there is a time and place for that, because when they go to a competition, when they get to a point where they're going to compete, there is no music. They need to know what it's like to lift in utter silence, because that can really trip up some people. So that does need to be prepared for as well. But yeah, I tend to have music down at a decibel so where I can be coaching and you can hear it, but you can hear me more. The other thing is, what we learn in teaching, you have comprehension checks. So it's going to be trial and error for you to figure out what works and what doesn't work with particular athletes. I always ask, it's very simple, you know, like if I give them something, I'll say, does that make sense to you? So if I tell you this, what do you think I mean? I mean, I'm asking so that they can tell me, they say, yep, that's what I want. So, okay, so when I say this, that's what I want. When you go through that, it's very trial and error. You keep doing that until you start establishing things that you can say with certain athletes, it resonates, others it does not. If I say stay on your heels as long as you can to four of my athletes. I know one that if I say that to him, he will literally fall on his bum because he's so kinesthetically aware. He puts everything all the way back. He goes too far, lands on his rear end, or is going to, he has a back pedal through. So I can't say that to him. I have to say, center your weight. It gives me the same result. But for him, if I say, keep your weight in your bum, it makes no sense to him. But if I say it to the other two on the platform, that may make sense to them. The luxury for me right now is a lot of my athletes are adults. So if something doesn't work, they just say, what do you mean when you say that? They'll just come right back and ask me. A child or younger athlete don't always ask because they think that you're going to think that they're dumb or whatever if they don't know what that means. So I ask them. I say, I want you to finish the pull. I want you to get a better extension. And as I'm talking, I've become more and more as I taught K-12 for years. And especially when I went through K-8, when I talk, I use a lot of body movement because I was a foreign language teacher for a long time. So when I want someone to stay going longer, and I'm doing the movement so that they see what I'm doing and then they hear what I'm saying and it makes more sense to them, So I end up just doing that now with everything I do. So if I want someone to extend, I'm like, yeah, I want you to extend more, and I'm showing them what I want. But I also, not while they're going through a set, but when they're done, I might explain briefly. I'm not going to get into this long soliloquy with them, but I want to educate them as to why this will, if I'm looking at the bigger limiting factor, if we fix this, then this will do this and this will do that. And then we won't have that problem in your catch, like you felt. And they're like, oh, okay. So they understand, they're starting to see a little bit, they don't totally get it, but they're starting to see more of what I'm looking for, which is the cause, not the result. And if I said, we fix this cause, then that result will be what we want. And I'm constantly just asking, it's that simple. Does that make sense to you? If I use a certain word, I'm gonna say like, I want you to get a better extension. And one of them turned to me and she said, do you mean get taller? Yeah. And that immediately tells me, okay, don't say extension with her, say taller. That makes sense to her. So it's very much knowing and communicating with your athlete and having that open where they can say, well, I've had athletes come up to me and it changes over time. What might work through the first 4 months, eventually it just gets old and it just doesn't work. So this is why you need to have a lot of different ideas and tools in your toolbox because there are several ways to ask for the same thing. And so you can just go through all these different ways until one days. And eventually that's going to start falling off the wall. It's like throwing spaghetti at the wall, right? So that's going to eventually fall down. So then we got to find another one. But the other thing too, is when you give them those correctives, you have to give them time to try and do it. So if we give them the corrective and then the next rep, they're still doing it, don't get on them again. Let them, The ones that we have when teaching, and this is what I teach in the undergrad here in strength and conditioning, the biggest ones that the students have trouble with are snatch balance and push jerking. I mean, there's a myriad of other things, but the majority of the time, those are the ones they get a little stuck with because of timing and things like that. So basically with those, I give them more sets, not more reps. I'll do like triples with them, but I'll say, let's do four. And I purposely give breaks. I stop them and give some instruction to give breaks. They think it's for instruction, which kind of is, but it's also to force them to take a break. But I'll do like three or four or five sets of three, but I keep it at really light loads, fairly light loads. I don't say anything. I tell them like, partners, you're looking for this. If I have a group of 15, I can't see everybody all at once. So I'll just say, all right, so partners. And I tell them exactly what I want them to look for. And I'll just say, first set, nobody say anything. Let them do what you're going to do. Don't correct it. Don't say, yeah, but you got to do this, or whatever. Second set, let me do the talking. So I go around. If somebody sees something, a partner sees something, they'll like raise their hand, flag me over, whatever. It's usually about the third set where all of a sudden it's starting to come together. It's not beautiful, perfect. It's not going to be, right? But the rhythm is there. So it's letting the body figure out this, what you're asking it to do. Because if it's totally new to them, they're just like, their body's going, what the, you want me to do what? I know it's going to take a little while for them to figure it out. So you have to give them that room. But again, if it meant that an injury was going to occur or something like that, then yeah, you would step in. But you do want to give them that time to implement it. Now, types of feedback. There are many different types of feedback, and they all seem to address or will address a lot of those learning styles. but not every athlete is going to respond the same to every feedback. So you have verbal instruction, again, using analogies, metaphors, and that's even with older adults as well, because if it's a new thing, and especially when you get like masters lifters that come in, like that are trying weightlifting for the first time, and if they have strength trained, but it's been a while or whatever it is, this is still new to them. And even if they were an athlete before, if they're an athlete in a different sport and they've done strength training or whatever, but not weightlifting, they come into weightlifting, they have mentally certain expectations of themselves because they were an athlete. So they're expecting a certain outcome and they'll get frustrated as well because A, this is like a brand new body, because the older they are, the more immobile they're going to become if they're not mobilizing. Okay. They're going to have days where they can't do things as well as, you know, you can't do several like harder, heavier, more taxing days in a row because they need that time to recover that we didn't need when we were younger. You know, things like that. So there's a lot of different things in dealing with that age group as well as youth. So youth and masters, you're kind of doing the same thing in terms of how you approach it and how you work in the mobility and stuff, because youth, they may have the mobility, but they can't control it, or they don't have the mobility because we got too many kids sitting around nowadays. You've got masters who maybe they have a desk job, so they do 8 hours a day, maybe just sitting down all day long. When you give verbal cues as well, they need to be very succinct. We don't want to give long stories. It's got to be very quick. It's got to have meaning. I explained to my athletes, I said, look, when I say tight, well, to specific athletes, you know, everyone has a different one, but this, well, like I've talked to one, I'll say, when I say tight to you, I mean, I want this and this. So all I have to say is tight, and you know I'm talking about this and this. I don't have to say the sentences to get those two things. I just say tight. That's my buzzword. That was something we talked about in the position stance as well. You can start by saying, look, I want you to, for example, with the girl that said taller, I said, I want you to get as high. I want you to touch your shoulders to your earlobes every single time you come up from your pull. And then she'll be like, okay. So I keep saying that. Okay. As we get through and she's getting more consistent with that, then I might say earlobes. I don't have to say, let's get your shoulders to your earlobes anymore. I might just say earlobes. She knows exactly what that means. There's reinforcement. That's another type of feedback. And that can be where I mentioned before. It can be verbal, nonverbal. It can be positive. It can be negative. Negative reinforcement doesn't have to be. There are, let's say there's two types of negative reinforcement. There's the kind where you're berating somebody or belittling. That to me is not reinforced. That doesn't even come into the gym. I don't understand how people think that that's effective, but to each his own, I guess. Negative reinforcement to me is me giving a critical assessment in a positive way. So I might just say, well, you're still not quite finishing that pull. So that's negative, but I'm going to sandwich it in with something that's positive. Like, but you did a really great job of staying tight. So if we can hold that same tightness off the floor, can we wait just a little bit longer and then finish that at the top? So I'm making that negative into a positive. And in teaching, we call it sandwiching. So you're going to positive, negative, positive. So if I'm asking them to do two things, I'm going to address the negative, the thing they didn't do well first, and then I'm going to immediately put in with something they did well. Because in human beings, and they've done psychological studies away from sport, but studies on stuff that shows that people remember everything after the but. So if you start with a positive and then say but, and then give a negative, all they're going to remember is the negative. So I start with the negative, or I'll say good effort. So I'm going to go positive, negative, positive. Good effort. Need a little more extension, but way to get yourself braced under that bar in the catch. So they're going to remember all of that. They're going to remember feeling good because they hear more positive, but they're like, okay, but yeah, I need to get that extension. So they don't feel so bad about the negative thing, but they're hearing it. And that's what we need. We need to make sure it's getting in there. So there's reinforcement there. Demonstrating or modeling, but make sure that whatever model, like this is another thing we've had discussions with. If a coach can't model it correctly, then find someone who can, or a video or something. Because if you're going to use modeling, you want them to see what you actually want to happen. But if you can, then by all means, you need to model as well. because your kinesthetic people, they usually can be visual as well. There's visual in there as well. So we've got verbal, we've got reinforcement. That's more of the psychological, but again, that's auditory. You're taking in, demonstrating is visual. Okay. A discovery learning is kinesthetic. And that'll be the next one that we're going into. And video is visual as well. And then manual manipulation, that's kinesthetic. But you're also giving audio at the same time. So, I mean, there's you know, our feedback and our methods of giving it are usually multi-methodical. Now you have video. And now there's pros and cons to video, to be honest. Now I have some people that are extremely visual, among other ways of learning. And they, to interpret what they're feeling, they actually can't have me just tell them initially. They can't have me just tell them. They actually need to see it. When they're doing certain things, I will video, or I'll ask, I said, do you need to see this? Because sometimes they'll say, no, I got what you're saying. And there are others that'll be like, could I? You know, because it just helps them. So I do, but I don't make video a big thing. Once we get that, I actually try to wean them off of that if I can. I pull it out when I need it. So video for us comes in those beginning stages, if we have people that really kind of just need to see, to get the initial, once they've got the consistent movement, that's usually when I see them start to say, no, I don't need video on that. I got it. Like they can feel now and they understand, interpret what they're feeling. The only other time that I pull it out is if they're testing in the facility that we're training, so that they can see it, so that they can, because sometimes they'll say like, oh, that was way too heavy, I couldn't have gone up. And I'm like, really? And I'll show them the video and they'll, oh man, I was really moving fast. That felt so slow. And I'm like, remember, I keep telling you, when it's under load, it's going to be, you feel like a house is on top of you, but you're doing fine. So it's just reinforcing some of the things you're telling them as a coach that they're not feeling. So they're kind of like, oh, you're right. I am. I'm just moving really fast. You know, so can we, do you want to go up? Well, yeah, now I do, you know, sort of thing. So it helps with that. But other than that, I don't really do the video. I'm very cautious with video instruction. And a video instruction to me is like, well, any of these actually are, like I'd said before, if you do it too often, they start to rely on that. So especially with video and verbal, if you're constantly showing or telling them before they have a chance to process themselves, they stop trying to process themselves. So you have to be really careful with all of this, that it doesn't become, that it's a tool and not, doesn't become a crutch or something that holds somebody back from catapulting forward. Because if they get too reliant on any kind of feedback, it's going to be detrimental to them in the long run. Does that help?
Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. Discovery is where you basically kind of, like I said, when I was talking about the snatch balance or the push jerk, you're kind of letting them explore through it a little bit on their own before you start jumping in and giving all the feedback. You got to be careful that you don't give them so much rope that they can hang themselves, if that makes any sense. You still are present. You still are the experienced one. You still have the eyes. You are their mirror. Okay, so you're telling them what you're seeing, but you do want to, especially with certain types of athletes, so you have to really, again, you have to know your athletes. Certain athletes, you can tell if you're giving too much information, it's going to overwhelm and they become more mechanical and they start to look like they hesitate and pause, and that you can seem like, oh, they're hesitating because they're not confident. Might be hesitating because they're thinking so much, because you're giving them so much stuff. So that's when you got to just really keep it simple. But discovery learning does have its place. They need to, because they need to actually work through these things. Now, will they do that in the cognitive stage? To a degree, but you've got to limit it because they don't know what they're doing. They don't know what they're feeling. So you still need to be behind the wheel, but they've moved from the back seat maybe to the front seat. Does that make sense? So the last one is manual manipulation. Now, of course, nowadays we need to be careful with that. You always need to be asking if it's okay if you show them by touching them, but you also have to be careful of where you touch and how you touch. But some athletes do still need it. So you can model it and then say, is it okay if I put you in that position and show you manually putting you there? Give them that option. If they would prefer just to constantly see you do it, then there you go. And they can try to mimic. But it does have its, okay, all of these, they all have their time and place. and in certain combinations. You just have to find the right ones and the ones you're comfortable with. Some coaches are not comfortable with touching their athletes at all. And that's not saying, oh, that's a bad coach. If you're not comfortable with it, the athlete's going to know. So you want to stick with things that you're comfortable with.
Are we done with the types of feedback?
Yeah, I just had one thing about probably need to know when to give it.
The timing.
Yeah. If you're deciding you want to give, obviously everybody wants to give some feedback. You don't just leave them out there to explore on their own. But when you give it and the type, there's names for a couple different types that you would have. And when you would choose to use them also is dependent on the type of learner you're working with. Because remember, we talked about cognitive, associative, and auto-regulatory. So we have two different types. And one's called terminal and one's called concurrent. So terminal just means that when their end terminated, okay, when their end of the rep or end of the set is when you would give the feedback. So it allows for the concentration on the skill because you're not talking while they're doing it. And that really works well with the cognitive stages and your associative stages to an extent. So you're looking at beginner and lower to intermediate. Intermediate high, you might be able to do some concurrent, but you want to sprinkle it in instead of just go switch all the way to that. And we'll get into concurrent in a minute. But the idea then is that you're letting them perform the lift because they already got enough to think about, right? When they're doing the lift, especially when they're a beginner. We don't want to be adding that. So you're just reminding them, say you have a couple cues before they go, might be something like, I don't know, stay tight and touch your earlobes. Okay. So we've gone through, let's say, because I've introduced those before. So tight back and make sure to touch your earlobes. Don't add anything else. And don't be doing that while they're lifting. You write it right before they go. They go. You can either say it again before the next rep, or you can wait till the end of the set, but you don't want to do it while they're lifting. And that's a terminal feedback. When you have someone who's more autonomous, so the movement patterns are much more ingrained. They're very consistent. You're obviously going to have one off or a miss here and there, but they're very consistent with their technique and they're comfortable with it. That's when you would have a concurrent, meaning that you're talking, you don't always have to, but you can talk while they're lifting. So for example, if I've got an athlete who's performing a clean and they've cut their pull, we'll keep going back to that one, but that seems to be a very popular thing that happens. But they cut their pull or their elbows, let's go with something different. They don't move their feet. And that happens, like sometimes, I'm sure you're lifting too, like even though it's a weight you can do, or even if it's in the heavier realm, it's like, you're confident to do it. You just don't think all of a sudden for some reason, you just didn't move your feet. You're thinking about something else. One foot moves or the other doesn't, or they both of them don't move, something. When that athlete, for example, has gone into the catch and they're starting to recover, I might say them, move your feet. So I'm talking to them right before they go into, I didn't wait to the end of the rep. I said it right then. So right when they put the bar down and they're going into that next rep, I don't have to say anything. I've already said it, right? So they can, when they're in that stage, they can focus on, in the lift, the basic majority, the main meat of the lift is consistently performed. The autonomous person can now focus on those little minute details that will make it even more efficient. And those are the things you can start really getting picky or addressing while they're lifting, but still keeping it at one or two. With an autonomous, I might go up to three, but I never go more than three things I want them to work on. But they're all three are very related so that they understand how that chain works together, so that it's not just things out in left field, so that it doesn't flow in their own mind.
I guess it comes down again to not being over-focused on being perfect all the time, because the learning will require us to explore a little bit and allow some mistakes.
Yeah.
Or at least some part of time while we fix the other things. So like the brain power has to shift and allow.
And as they become, when they become more comfortable and confident, they're able to see and tackle more things at the same time than they are at those lower stages. So we have to recognize where the athlete is at, and we have to, again, meet them where they're at and push them that little bit, that one plus, instead of trying to go to two, you know, because they're not ready for that. Even if an athlete's physically ready, I mean, you have some athletes that come in that are just physically gifted, but they're still novices. So that doesn't mean that we should be pushing them to train, even though physically, if they knew all the positions well, they could perform like an Olympian today, you know, or make Commonwealths, you know, in the next year. That doesn't mean that they're actually cognitively ready to do that, because they don't know, even physically, because they still don't know things consistently enough. So pushing them through to get there faster doesn't help that athlete. And most times, and I would love to see a study on this for around the world, but my experience and what I've seen, and just even the athletes that I've coached at international levels, like how often I see one come back every year, you know, because youth and junior year, the composite there is what, 5-6 years. And then senior obviously lasts a much longer. How often do I see those same athletes coming through year after year after year? Or do they stop after a while? And then you're like, I'm talking to my friends or their coaches, say, well, whatever happened to so-and-so. If you're pushing somebody through before, you know, because then they think that everything is this easy. And then when it gets hard, they don't like it. Because what do you mean? All of a sudden, I'm not getting these massive PBs, and it's actually taking me longer to get a 5 kilo gain. There must be something wrong with you, because we've basically made it so that it's that easy at the beginning and didn't prepare them for the rest of that career. Because this career, actually, your best athletes aren't the ones that come in this first, second, third year. The athletes we're seeing at the Olympics and Commonwealth Games are the ones that have been in the sport, most of them, for 6-7 years. And so if we got a guy at 2 years that's saying, this isn't moving fast enough, or why can't it be this way, or you're not doing this and whatever, or this is too hard now, we didn't prepare them for that stage, because that first 2 years is the honeymoon stage. Like I said before, you can hit them with a stick and they're going to get better, but that doesn't mean it's the right way to do it. So, and we need to prepare them. You know, I've had athletes now transitioning from their third into their fourth. It's getting real now. Like, they're putting in the same amount of time, and it's getting harder to get those gains, which it will. And they're looking at me, and one of them just turned to me and goes, this is what you meant, isn't it? And they're like, yeah, I didn't lie to you. I mean, I wasn't just making that up. And they're just like, yeah. And then we actually have to do different strategies to keep them psychologically engaged and keep pushing themselves. So, I mean, different stages require different goals, different ways to attack those goals, and different ways to and process them and analyze them and take those steps and figure out what those steps, the intermediary steps are. And then especially if they get injured, because that may happen as well.
You said you are open to people contacting you. So I have to throw it here, how people can find you.
They could go to LinkedIn, that I am on there. Fastest way, however, is probably just emailing. And that's the ninjahoff@gmail.com. So
awesome. And the last question, I asked you about the colors last time. So now I will ask you, which is your favorite lift tool? Execute and to coach, and why?
To execute, I like cleans.
Why?
All of them. Yeah, I like cleans. And this is gonna sound like every other young athlete comes in, I was good at it. Wow. It was easy. I liked cleans and squatting, back squatting, not front squatting. I did it. It was a necessary evil, but I liked cleans and squat cleans and back squats. I could do those all day long, especially from cleans from the knee. I think that was my. I did knee blocks. I was just like, yes, I get to push this today, you know? Yeah. To coach, anything where I see the light bulb come on, it doesn't matter to me. It could be the smallest thing. If I see the athlete like get it, and that light bulb, they're like, oh, yeah, okay. And then they just go, and then this like this whole new, I feel like I've done my job. And that just makes it so, I just love it. Yeah. We ask that in training. We do that all the time, especially when we have the new people come in. We'll have this big talk with everybody in the room so that the new person doesn't feel whatever they might be feeling. But we're always like, I have this guy coming now, and he doesn't quite understand the snatch. He does it just fine, but it doesn't feel as fluid to him as the clean. And so he always says, I don't like the snatch. I said, you don't like it? I said, why don't we change the script on that? Because we don't want to come in thinking negatively about it. I said, why don't we think of things that we need to work on to make this so that it feels as confident as you do on the clean? I said, but I get it. You're going to like one lift more than the other. I totally get that. I said, Snatch wasn't my favorite thing for a while either. I said I didn't understand it. I didn't truly understand it until I was probably in my mid-30s. And then it was like, oh, yeah, I like this now. This is fine. A little late, though. But yeah, we'll ask people in the room, like, what's your favorite exercise? What's your least favorite exercise? So yeah, you get going around the room and hear everybody's, you know, things so that, you know, they feel like they're not odd man or whatever. It's like, oh, trust me, these guys don't love every single thing we give them. But yeah, so I would say, yeah, I definitely, anything that they finally just see, like there's a spark, then yeah, that's all it takes for me. I'm easy. I'm an easy date.
Okay, I think we should end here on a positive note. Thank you so much for your talk today and the previous interview.
Yeah, it was a great experience. Thank you for having me.